Hello, and welcome to the November 2013 podcast for the IFRS Interpretations Committee, looking at the proceedings of the Interpretation Committee meeting on the 12th and 13th of November 2013. My name is Michael Stewart, Director of Implementation Activities at the IASB, and I'm joined today by Won Hee Han, Koichiro Kuramochi, and Anna Heining to talk about some of the issues that were discussed at the November Interpretation Committee meeting. I should say before we start that the comments and views that you hear will be those of the presenters and not necessarily those of the IFRS Interpretations Committee or the International Accounting Standards Board. The full details of the committee meeting can be found in the IFRIC update newsletter on the ISB's website. Now, the first issue we'd like to start with today is relating to investment entities. And the Interpretations Committee discussed various issues relating to the investment entity amendments to IFRS 10. Now, Koichiro, what can you tell us about these?
Yes, Michael. So, during the November Interpretations Committee meeting, the committee discussed various issues related to the investment entity amendments to IFRS 10. The IASB published the amendment last year, and the revised IFRS 10 required that an investment entity should not consolidate investees, but measures those investments at fair value. We received the submission, which had various issues. During the November meeting, the Interpretation Committee tentatively agreed the agenda decision for one issue and decided to discuss rest of the issues for potential revision of the standards at the future meeting.
Okay, so what was the issue that the committee reached an agenda decision on?
Right. So, as I mentioned, investment entity should measure its investees at fair value. That's a principle. However, there is an exception. If investment entity has subsidiaries which provide investment-related services, the investment entity should consolidate that particular subsidiary. The issue was, if an investment entity parent creates certain tax optimization subsidiary in certain jurisdictions, for example in tax haven, if the subsidiary should be consolidated or measured at fair value. So that is the question. And the submission presented very specific structure for the tax optimization subsidiary, and this is particularly important because our tentative agenda decision is based on that structure. The structure was, some investment entities establish wholly owned intermediate subsidiaries in certain jurisdictions which own the portfolio of investments in the group structure. The sole purpose of the intermediate subsidiaries is to minimize tax paid by investors in the parent investment entity. And there is no other activities within that subsidiaries, and the tax advantage comes about simply by virtue of returns being channeled through the jurisdiction of the subsidiaries. So the question was, if the tax optimization subsidiary, as stated on the submission, should be consolidated or measured at fair value.
Okay, so where did the committee get to with its discussions?
Well, the Interpretation Committee noted that IASB specifically discussed this particular issue when they finalized the investment entity amendment last year. The basis of conclusion BC272 of IFRS 10 addresses the issue. So basically, the parent investment entity do not need to consolidate the subsidiary, instead just measure at fair value. So that's the conclusion. So accordingly, the committee tentatively agreed to issue the agenda decision.
Okay. And that, of course, is out for comment for 60 days.
Exactly.
So anybody who has a different view, disagrees, can write in and let us know, and we'll bring that to a future meeting.
Exactly. We are waiting for their response.
Great. And what were the other issues that you said were included in the original submission?
Right. So there are two other issues we discussed in the committee meeting. So one issue is, also related to the exception for the investment entity amendment. So, as mentioned, if the investment entity has subsidiaries which provide investment-related service, the investment entity should consolidate these subsidiaries. However, there are situations the subsidiary which provide investment-related services can be investment entity and can have the investees. So in those kind of situations, hybrid type situation.
So it does both. It both
exactly.
provides investment-related services and is an investment entity in its own right.
Exactly. Yeah. In those situations, the question is what kind of accounting the parent should do. So that's the question. And there was the other issue we discussed. That is related to exemption to present consolidated financial statement. Paragraph 4 of IFRS 10 states that a parent need not present consolidated financial statements if the parent meets certain conditions. One of the conditions is if its ultimate or any intermediate parent produce consolidated financial statements that are available for public use and comply with IFRS. The question arises because investment entity parent does not produce consolidated financial statement. It produces separate financial statements and also subsidiaries at fair value. So the question is, investment entity can use the exemption from presenting consolidated financial statements.
So this is the subsidiary that sits beneath the investment entity because its ultimate parent doesn't appear consolidated. Does it mean that it does or does not get the exemption itself from preparing consolidated financial statements?
Exactly, that is the issue.
So both of those additional issues, they will be looked at again at a future meeting.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next issue relates to IAS 17 and leases and a question raised about incremental costs. Now, Anna, what exactly was the question that we were being asked with this one?
Yeah, Michael. So as you said, the issue raised in the November meeting related to the meaning of incremental cost in the context of current lease accounting in IAS 17. And more specifically, the submitter wanted to know whether fixed salary costs for permanent employees that spend substantially all of their time negotiating and arranging new leases and or loans, whether those costs qualify as incremental costs that should be included in the initial measurement of the lessor's finance lease receivable.
Okay, and where did the Interpretations Committee get to with their discussions on this issue?
Yeah, so we recommended that the Interpretations Committee should not take the issue onto its agenda, and that's because we concluded that the guidance in IAS 17 is clear, and we also understand that there is no diversity in practice. And we noted that the ISB is currently undertaking a project on leases, and so the IAS 17 will eventually be replaced, and therefore it might not be efficient to provide an interpretation. The Interpretations Committee agreed with our recommendation and decided that neither an interpretation nor an amendment was necessary, and therefore decided not to add the issue on its agenda. The Interpretations Committee also clarified that only those costs that would not have been incurred if the entity had not negotiated and arranged a lease qualify as incremental costs, and therefore internal fixed costs would not qualify as incremental.
Okay. And again, this is a tentative agenda decision, so ask for comment for 60 days.
Correct.
And then we'll look at it again in March.
That's correct.
Great. Thank you. Now, the next issue that we want to take a look at is, again, another item which was proposed for a tentative agenda decision, and it relates to IAS 39, Financial Instruments Recognition and Measurement, and specifically about accounting for term-structured repo transactions. Now, the submitter asked us to clarify whether three different transactions should be accounted for separately, or should they be aggregated and accounted for as if it was a single derivative transaction. Now, Wonhee, could you describe for us the fact patterns of the three transactions just briefly?
Yes, Michael. We have two parties, entity Alpha and entity Theta, and they entered into three transactions on the same day. Transaction 1 is a bond purchase deal. Entity Alpha purchases a bond from entity Theta. Transaction 2 is an interest rate swap that starts on the same day as the purchase date of transaction 1 and has the same maturity date as the bond. In this interest rate swap transaction, entity Alpha pays a fixed rate of interest equal to the fixed coupon rate of the purchased bond in transaction 1 and receives a variable rate of interest. Transaction 3 is a repurchase agreement in which entity Alpha sells the same bond in transaction 1 to entity Beta on the same day it purchases the bond and agrees to buy back the bond at the maturity date of the bond.
Okay. So the interpretations committee looked at these three transactions, and where did their discussion take them?
Yes, the interpretation committee noted that the fact pattern provided in the submission does not provide enough context or detail to assess whether the three transactions should be accounted for separately or should be aggregated. In addition, the committee members agreed that providing guidance on the accounting for a specific transaction would not be appropriate. However, the Interpretations Committee observed that in order to determine whether entity Alpha should aggregate and account for the three transactions as a single derivative, reference may be made to paragraphs B.6 and C.6 of Guidance on Implementing IAS 39 and paragraph AG 39 of IAS 32. Consequently, the committee tentatively decided not to add this issue to its agenda.
Okay. Now, the submitter also asked us how to apply paragraph IGB6 of R39 in addressing the first issue, which is how an entity should account for the three transactions, whether it should be separately or aggregated as a single transaction. What was the committee's discussion on that point?
Yes. The Interpretation Committee noted that application of the guidance in paragraph IGB6 of I-39 requires a judgment. It also noted that the indicators in IGB6 of I-39 may assist an entity to determine the substance of the transactions, but the presence or absence of any one specific indicator alone might not be conclusive. Consequently, the committee tentatively decided not to add this issue to its agenda as well.
Okay. And as with the others, this is open for comment for 60 days, and we'll look at this again in March. Then, staying with you, Wonhee, and looking at another issue, this one relates to joint arrangement. Now, we had had some issues earlier this year submitted to us relating to IFRS 11 on joint arrangements. And given that this is a new standard and we've had these three different submissions come to us, I know that we thought we would undertake some outreach to just see if there were some other things we should be thinking about at the same time. Now, we undertook that outreach over the summer and we've had results in. Now, Wonhee, can you describe briefly the summary of what we heard through that outreach?
Yes, Michael. In the outreach request, we summarized five principal issues raised in the submission and asked whether the views on these five issues were properly identified. We also asked whether the stakeholders have additional issues. We have received 21 additional issues on top of the five issues we already identified in the outreach request. In our paper presented to the Interpretations Committee at this meeting, we classified all issues by category. Category A relates to the classification of a joint arrangement. Category B relates to a specific topic relating to the classification of a joint arrangement, which is a change in the classification of a joint arrangement. Category C relates to the recognition and measurement of a joint arrangement. Category D relates to a specific topic regarding the recognition and measurement of a joint arrangement, that is, how to recognize and measure a joint arrangement with respect to losing joint control or acquiring interest while retaining a joint control. And lastly, Category E relates to other issues including transition provisions and first-time application.
Okay, so we've categorized these to help the Interpretations Committee approach these. And where did they get to with their discussion about what we had heard?
Yes, the Interpretations Committee agreed that some issues should be given a priority. The committee members noted that, broadly speaking, two priority issues should be addressed for further consideration. The two issues are, first, whether an assessment of other facts and circumstances should take into account facts and circumstances that do not involve contractual and legal enforceable terms, and second, how the parties to a joint corporation should recognize assets, liabilities, revenues, and expenses, especially if the parties' interest in these assets and liabilities differ from their ownership interest in the joint corporation. The Interpretations Committee also asked the staff to identify the issues that would require further guidance and the issues that can be resolved in the context of the current standard. In response to the committee's request, we will present an analysis at a future Interpretations Committee meeting.
Okay, so the Interpretations Committee has identified these two particular areas which they would like us to focus on. I know some of the discussion at the Interpretations Committee was on about whether, in fact, some of the other issues should be, we should allow practice to develop and perhaps look at some of those as part of the post-implementation review, but these were the two areas which they thought were warranted looking at by them at a future meeting, so we will bring those back. Now, I know that there was another issue related to joint arrangements that was discussed at the November meeting. And this other issue was relating to circumstances where you do have a joint operation, that type of joint arrangement, and where that joint operation is conducted through another entity, a separate vehicle. There have been some questions raised about the accounting in that situation, and the Interpretations Committee in that case felt that the standards, IFRS 11, requires that when you do have a joint operation, that the accounting in the separate and the consolidated financial statements was clear, that that was required to be the same, and that the joint operator would account for all of its rights and obligations in relation to that joint operation. It also noted that in those circumstances, that instead of accounting for the investment in that separate entity, the joint operator would instead just account for the assets and liabilities that it has as a result of its rights and obligations connected with that joint operation. And that is some feedback that we'll be taking to the ISB at a future meeting to provide the Interpretation Committee's feedback on that particular issue. Well, that brings us to the end of the podcast for the November Interpretations Committee meeting 2013. The full record is available in the IFRIC Update newsletter, which is available on the ISB website. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.